You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Marsha Coleman Adebayo made headlines in 2000 when she won an anti-discrimination and anti-harassment suit against her employer, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. But she made history 2 years later when a Whistleblower Protection Act inspired by her case against the EPA became the first civil rights legislation passed in the 21st century. That law was called No Fear, and it's the name she's given the memoir she's written about her struggles and triumphs. And the book is published by Lawrence Hill Books. I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo to our show today. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well. No Fear is an acronym. What does it stand for?
It stands for the Notification of Federal Employees Anti-Discrimination and Retaliation Act.
Wow. The No Fear legislation was designed to give government employees recourse when they face discrimination, but hasn't No Fear inspired training programs to help federal employees understand their rights?
Every 2 years, every federal employee must take No Fear training. Every federal employee, all millions of them. And upon 90 days of joining the federal government, you must be trained in the No Fear Act. And so for the first time, federal employees really do have a sense of what their rights are in the federal government.
You've also founded the No Fear Coalition, a group of civil rights and whistleblower organizations.
That's correct.
What does that do?
The No Fear Coalition is an ad hoc group that focuses on activism on Capitol Hill. It was the group that provided the boots on the ground for the passage of the No Fear Act. We wrote letters, we marched, we demonstrated. We educate the public about the need to safeguard the rights of whistleblowers in the federal government.
Now, the EPA, its name says it's about protecting the environment.
Right.
Some of the treatment you've described being subjected to while working at the EPA is really shocking, including the story about your boss offering to make you an honorary white man so that you could join a group of colleagues sitting around a table at a routine meeting. How did you react to that?
You know, I in shock. I mean, I guess that's really the only way to react to something like that when you're having your humanity questioned in a professional setting. I understood, as I think anyone would understand, that what he was actually doing was belittling me in the context of my colleagues. And he was making it clear, whether it was conscious or unconscious on his part, that my role would always be almost a comedic role in the office, regardless of the high quality of work I was producing. And so it was one of those moments when it all came together for me, and it was quite clear that regardless of how brilliant I was, how well I performed at my job, I was simply going to be the butt of a joke. Everyone around the room laughed when he made that statement, when I walked in. And I should tell you that after he called me an honorary white man, another colleague walked into the room who was a black male, and he repeated the same statement. I'm going to also make you an honorary white man. But my colleague was much quicker on his feet than I was, because I sat there like a deer in headlights, like, oh my God, I don't believe he just said this to me. And my colleague said to him, oh, no, I will not take that from you or anyone else. And I repeat this story in the book. It was one of the first indications to me that the EPA was not what it was really sort of messaged out, or wasn't really what it was supposed to be.
And when was this?
This was about, I think, 6 to 8 months after I started working at EPA and around 19. This is a couple years after I worked there. I think around maybe 1992.
So Bill Clinton had just become president?
Well, and that gave me a great deal of hope. I had hoped that the Clinton administration would signal a change in the way things were in the EPA. I was at the World Wildlife Fund, WWF, before I came to the EPA, and I worked with EPA former administrator Bill Riley. And in fact, I found his administration in many ways more pro-environment than later on in the Clinton administration, which I've always sort of seen as an irony. But Bill Riley was an environmentalist. He was a conservationist with very deep roots in the environmental community. Once the administration turned over and Bill Clinton's administration came to power, I actually went to the administrator's office and reported what was happening to me in the Office of International Activities.
In fact, you filed a number of complaints,
yes,
about how you were being treated, and you faced much more serious and frightening threats. You say that you even got rape threats and death threats?
Such as, don't be surprised if you go to your car this evening and when you put your foot on the accelerator, you get a big bang. Those kind of threats.
Wow.
It was so bad that at one point, and this is closer to when I was going to trial, that I had security walk me to my car. My husband would pick me up. I received a phone message on my cell phone with a very detailed and graphic rape threat, which is also in the book. So without executive leadership, without an administrator signaling to EPA administrator that these kinds of statements will not be tolerated and that there are consequences and repercussions for this kind of behavior, there's no sense in the community, in the EPA or any institution, of the boundaries that people can and cannot go. And so one of the problems that I had was that there was no leadership signaling to people, you may not cross this line.
It's also worth noting that you were a senior staff member in the EPA's Office of the Administrator when all of this happened. You had earned a PhD at MIT, had several years' experience working for the United Nations on development issues in Africa. You'd been hired in 1990 by the EPA's Office of International Activities as part of a team of experts to help the EPA broaden its global reach and effectiveness through its relationship with NGOs. So you weren't a junior staff member here.
No. I'd also been a professor at American University and maybe at that time Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. No, so I was senior. I was short of SES. I was senior staff.
But do you think it's because of race? Do you think it's because you're a woman, or is it because you were already expressing certain opinions that went against what other members of the EPA would have preferred to hear?
I think it was probably a little bit of all of the above. When I joined the EPA in the Office of International Activities, they had never had a senior black person on staff in a professional role. And so the EPA actually went out and recruited African Americans to add to the diversity and wisdom of that office. But of course, we weren't really supposed to participate. We were supposed to be seen and not heard. And so I think they were actually surprised in a way when I started speaking out. My other colleague had a master's degree, I think, from Princeton or Yale, when he started speaking out. And it was almost like, oh, my God, you can talk too? I mean, the racism was that fundamental, I think, in the agency.
And you think it was unique to the EPA?
No, I don't think it was unique to the EPA. I think what was happening at the EPA was happening throughout the federal government.
Wow. Well, your book follows two intertwined stories, one which we've already touched on. It focuses on your fight to expose the racism and sexism you encountered at the EPA. But the second story, which is much less widely known, concerns your efforts to bring a group of miners being poisoned by work that they were doing in the U.S.-owned vanadium mine in Brits, South Africa, to the light.
Yeah, that's probably the story that I've tried the hardest to get out. And
that's why
I've
you wrote
mentioned
this book.
It. That's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I mentioned it in my New York Times op-ed. I mentioned it before Congress when I've testified. And yet no one has really picked up the story. And so I decided to write the book, not only to talk about the passage of the first civil rights law, which, again, a lot of people had not heard about, but also to talk about this community in South Africa that I found out about when I became the executive secretary of what was called the Gore Mbeki Commission. Now, the Gore Mbeki Commission was a flagship foreign policy instrument after Nelson Mandela became president, and the United States wanted to show its concrete support theoretically, for the transition to democracy under Nelson Mandela. And so this Gore-Mbeki Commission was established.
Two vice presidents.
By Al Gore and Thabo Mbeki. We met alternatively between Washington and South Africa every 6 months. So this was a very high-level commission. And I was in charge of the environment part of this commission. And I found out in my official capacity that a U.S. multinational was responsible for unsafe conditions in a mine in South Africa. And they were mining a substance called vanadium pentoxide. And I reported that to my supervisors at EPA. And that was still a question mark. You know, is this multinational corporation actually carrying out these activities? And at that point, I was told to shut up.
My guest is Marsha Coleman Adebayo. Her book, No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA. You were told to shut up by whom?
I was told to shut up by my immediate supervisor, but it was also with an addition to that. And that is, we've just placed you into a beautiful new office. Instead of spending all your time thinking about all these little, you know, disagreeable issues, why don't you spend your time decorating your office?
Somebody actually said that to you.
Yes. And so, you know, I've just told an EPA official who is, you know, charged with supporting and protecting public health that people are dying somewhere, and I'm supposed to have a Martha Stewart moment.
So let's talk about vanadium. I'm sure very few of my listeners even have heard that word before. What is it and how is it used?
Vanadium is a substance that's found buried deep in the Earth's crust. And it's sort of a goldish white metal that is sort of extracted from the Earth's surface, the crust of the Earth, and it's used. It's a very important metal. If I can just tell you that Henry Ford actually was one of the first people to really understand the importance of vanadium, because his Model T Fords kept cracking because of the weather conditions in Detroit. You know, Detroit has extreme weather conditions, very hot, very cold, and the Model T kept cracking during the winter. And so when he found vanadium, he found that by mixing vanadium in with the steel, it provided the steel the ability, the flexibility to expand and contract. You see, that's the reason why our planes can take off on the ground and go into the Earth's atmosphere without cracking. You know, so laptops, microphones, pacemakers, forks, spoons, knives, cars, refrigerators, they all have vanadium. And that's the reason why the CIA classifies vanadium as a strategic metal for the United States.
And why is it dangerous to mine?
Well, in its organic form, in its unrefined form, it's the dust that comes off of the vanadium. And the miners inhale the dust, the vanadium dust, and it becomes very toxic. And in fact, the symptoms of vanadium poisoning are very acute.
And then you learned about the dangers because somebody approached you. He assumed that you, as an official of the EPA, would have the power to help change things.
Jacob Ongukani was an environmental activist and a member of KUSATU, which is the Congress of South African Trade Unions. And he came to me and he told me about this community that was suffering from the most horrendous exposures from vanadium poisoning. And again, I went back to my supervisors and I told them about it, and basically nothing happened. And so what I did was, as the executive secretary, I was actually able to mobilize enough support in the committee to take this before the commission and have them vote on whether or not we should impanel an independent team of scientists to go to South Africa and actually investigate vanadium poisoning. But guess what? When I tried to do my job, I was stopped.
And listeners might want to put their fingers to their ears for a moment when I describe some of the things that are the result of vanadium exposure: sores on the skin, shortness of breath, nausea, bleeding from the nose, eyes, genitals, rectum, impotence, bright green tongues. Yeah. And a couple of years after you met Mr. Ngatkani, You learned that workers in the mine had a greatly shortened lifespan. Many of them die from respiratory or renal failure after only 15 or 20 years of work. Have things improved at all?
No, unfortunately, my investigation was stopped. I was replaced by someone who was an expert in private sector matters, which was really the goal of the process from the very beginning. I mean, what I talk about in my book is that I was really the Trojan horse. The EPA wasn't really interested in humanitarian environmental issues. I mean, I was to open the gates so that the private sector folks could march in after me. And perhaps that was sort of the value of having an African-American on board, because with the new South Africa Mandela government, obviously they were more receptive to talking to me than maybe other people. And once I opened the gate, the EPA felt I had done my job. And then they marched in with all the private sector initiatives.
We'll continue this conversation after we take a little break. My guest is Marsha Coleman Adebayo. Her book, No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA. It is a foreword by Noam Chomsky, and it's published by Lawrence Hill Books. Stay with us. We're back with Marsha Coleman Adebayo. Her book, No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA. It's published by Lawrence Hill Books. So who owned this mine that was causing so much trouble for the miners?
Well, according to the miners themselves, many of whom talked to me about this situation, particularly one miner that I can think of, had been with the mine for some time, and he brought out papers showing me that the original name of the mine was the Union Carbide Vanadium Mine. So then you begin to trace the history of the mine, and I think it probably retained that name until around Bhopal, and then when Union Carbide begins to break up into different subsidiaries.
So then it became Vametco. It's now called Strategic Minerals Corporation. But are you suggesting that it's still Union Carbide?
Well, of course, there is no Union. Union Carbide broke up after Bhopal. And assumed,
which killed several thousand Indians while they slept,
exactly,
if we remember correctly.
Exactly.
So, but in the end, it winds up part of that same corporation. Does the EPA's arm extend past the United States?
Well, we were involved in a bilateral organization. And so to the extent that the United States government is having bilateral discussions and we have an agreement between the South African government and the United States government, there's some flexibility in terms of having conversations and having agreements between the two countries.
There's a film called Come Back Africa, which was filmed during the apartheid years, and it was about the unsafe mining conditions in South Africa in those years. But we're talking about post-apartheid South Africa. Yet we have these unsafe conditions, and there were always unemployed men lined up outside the mine hoping to get hired despite all the dangers that I'm sure they'd been told about.
Mining is an intergenerational activity. You find fathers and sons and grandfathers working for the same mine. One of the, I think, scary parts of this whole process is that it's now that women are also becoming miners. And we have absolutely no health data in terms of the impact of vanadium poisoning on the health of women.
So you were part of this Gore and Mbeki Commission. Couldn't you just bring what you'd learned to them?
I did. Oh, I absolutely did. I brought a petition to the commission to ask for an independent investigation. And it was approved. I was very excited. I talk a great deal in the book about calling South Africa and saying, okay, the forces are coming to help you. And then only to try to work out the details of the trip planning and have every single step stymied.
And you discovered that your colleagues and your superiors were being made rather uncomfortable by this.
Of course. It's actually not humorous, but at one point I was making such a fuss about not allowing me to carry out my responsibilities. My supervisor said, okay, enough already. We'll send a medical doctor to South Africa. And if he comes back and says there's a problem, then we'll implement it. The only problem with that is that when I spoke to the doctor and asked him how he was going to carry out his job, he told me he was a veterinarian.
And the investigation ended before the Gore and Mbeki Commission was disbanded?
I was removed. I was removed, and I was removed by my supervisors on the basis that I wasn't, quote unquote, a team player, and that I felt too close to Black South Africans.
So race was brought into this conversation as well?
Absolutely.
It's hard to decide whether your treatment is the result of racism, sexism, Washington politics, or just retaliation for somebody who wasn't playing the game.
My guess is that the problem was that I was exposing a U.S. multinational corporation. And whenever there is that delicate balance between public health and profits from a corporation, particularly a U.S. corporation, almost always the corporations win.
So a short time later, you were dismissed from the EPA's Office of International Activities. Were you able to find another job within the EPA?
You know, I became an EPA nomad, which means you go from office to office looking for a place. But once you become, once you whistleblow, you're blackballed within the agency, and no one really wants you to be around because they don't know when you're going to find corruption, because corruption is endemic in the agency, and when you're also going to have the conscience to blow the whistle again. So you're an unwelcome guest at the table at that point.
And your new boss told you you weren't allowed to work on any issues related to South Africa.
And that was in the Office of Environmental Justice.
So what did you do? You developed a new environmental justice newsletter at the Office of Environmental Justice, and then you were hired by the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics to work on domestic issues. So you weren't completely blacklisted.
No, I suppose I wasn't. I was forbidden from practicing my specialization, which is African environmental protection.
But you were given Al Gore's Vice Presidential Hammer Award for,
yes,
your work on reducing mercury in American hospitals.
Right, right. No, I'm productive. And I suppose one of the reasons why I was able to stay at the EPA as long as I was able to stay there was because I was productive. I didn't just sit there. I continued to produce good work. But at some point, my conscience began to pull on me again.
And South Africa started pulling on you again.
It started the voices of the vanadium workers, the green tongues, the black tongues. I had to find out what happened in South Africa.
My guest is Marsha Coleman Adebayo. Her book, No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA. It is a foreword by Noam Chomsky, and it's published by Lawrence Hill Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you decided to go back to South Africa. What was the reaction at the EPA when they heard that you were going back there?
They were not very happy about that. I remember going, my supervisor calling me in his office and saying, did you apply for a visa to South Africa? And my first response was, how would you know that? And he said, well, the embassy contacted us. And I'm thinking, okay, I apply for a visa and lights go off between South Africa and the United States. But since I was going back as a private citizen, no one could stop me.
But you did bring a doctor, a couple of doctors,
right,
and your daughter?
The first time, I took a couple of doctors with me. And the second time, I approached my alma mater from Barnard College here in New York City. And my college actually provided 4 students and 2 professors on my second trip to South Africa
to investigate
vanadium.
Mm-hmm. So you went to the mine with the doctors.
Yes.
But then you found yourself threatened again?
Oh, there was no question about that. We went to the mines. First of all, I became sick just being on the mine. I was exposed to vanadium dust.
You can't just wear a mask?
At that point, to be honest with you, I wasn't even that educated about vanadium pentoxide. I mean, I was just an American sort of going to the mine to find out what was going on. And with a little bit of research, I had no idea at that time how toxic it was. Remember, we had never carried out our independent investigation. And so I went there, you know, naively trying to understand on a personal and professional level what was happening to the miners.
And an official seemed to suggest that he was going to kidnap your daughter?
Yeah, we were actually mining. Danny Glover had taken interest in this story. And on one of the tours, he had provided a film crew to go with me to record the stories of the vanadium miners. And we were recording when I heard commotion behind me. and someone said, "It's your daughter," and we quickly cut off the cameras and ran. And the miners had actually surrounded my daughter. She was standing on the inside of this circle. She was about 8 years old then. And they described to me, I saw this, I heard someone running, and they said that one of the people from the mine had come over and was playing with my daughter. And then they saw her walking off with him. And all the miners ran, and they grabbed her, and they surrounded and protected her. And they told me that she was in the process of walking away with this guy who was a known stooge for the mining plant.
The story you tell here concludes after your court victory and the passage of the No Fear Act in 2002. But I'm curious about what's happened since. How long were you able to continue working at the EPA after these legal decisions were handed down?
Well, I won my case. I won on the basis of race, color, sex, and a hostile work environment, which was groundbreaking. Only 2% of us who take our cases to court win. And so when I won my case, it was breaking news in Washington, D.C.
But you can't work in an office that you've won a case
like that again.
I certainly did.
I went back to my office. They had removed the computer in my file cabinets when I got there. But I went back to the office. And it was interesting because everywhere I went, people kept, you know, there were demonstrations at EPA after I won. People took to the streets with demonstrations. They were so happy about this because finally someone had been able to break through this barrier and win a case. And then, of course, Congress found out about it. And there were congressional hearings and, as you said, the introduction of the first civil rights law. But it was very difficult. You're right. It was very difficult to work at EPA after I won.
Well, you say the stress really had an effect on your health.
I became ill. I became ill with hypertension and some other stress-related illnesses. And eventually I had to work at home because I had become so ill. I was taken away by ambulance a couple of times. It's worth noting that one of the people who testified for me, John Gran, was actually quote-unquote set up by the EPA and ended up going to prison for 6 months after he testified for me. So there was a lot of I knew that if they would take such stringent measures against a white man, that they wouldn't hesitate to try to also do something to me.
So what's happened since you did leave the EPA?
I didn't just leave the EPA. I was fired from the EPA. I was fired during the transition between the Bush administration and the Obama administration.
So you stayed all the years through the Bush administration?
I did. I was there. I was actually fired when the president brought back Carol Browner as head of the transition team. I mean, my case is Coleman Adebayo v. Carol M. Browner. And when I saw Carol Browner walk through the doors of EPA during the transition period, I said to my husband, I should be receiving my termination notice pretty soon. And within 2 weeks, I received a termination notice.
And why was that? Was she part of the problem as you saw it?
Well, I took Carol Browner to court. My case was against the Carol Browner administration.
So she took it personally?
I assume so. We'll find out because I'm now taking a new case back to court in which she will be on the witness stand. So we will find out what happened.
And what are you doing now?
I wrote a book called No Fear, Whistleblower's Triumph. And I'm promoting my book. I'm working on a movie with Danny Glover to bring this book to life on the big screen. I'm also working with another filmmaker on an independent film. And I'm on a book tour now, so I'm quite busy.
And what do you hear from South Africa? You said before conditions really haven't improved at all?
Nothing has really changed, unfortunately. They went on a strike about 6 months ago to increase their pay from about $1.40 an hour to $1.70 an hour. But the strike was not successful.
So in the end, you may have won, but the people you were fighting for have not.
There have been some improvements, I must say. They have better masks now than they did when we first started the struggle. They have gloves to wear when they're touching and in contact with this matter. There have been some improvements in the health services around the plant, but we're still far from a total victory.
Do you have any friends at the EPA?
Oh, of course.
And do they tell you what's going on now? Do you think things have improved there?
I have a lot of friends at EPA, and I'm in touch with what's going on. I think things have not really improved the way we had hoped they would improve. The No Fear Act has clearly helped a lot because people understand what their rights are now. We're still a long way from parity within the federal government, and it's still a challenge for people to blow the whistle without repercussions. So we still need stronger whistleblower law, which is the reason why Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee has introduced No Fear 2 now.
Mm-hmm. What is No Fear 1 not protect you from?
Well, No Fear 1 provides a lot of rights in terms of understanding your situation, providing Congress with information, making sure that the slush fund, which was in play when I was going through my court case, has now been eliminated, and now agencies must pay when they're found to have discriminated. No Fear 2 provides more access to attorneys, because one of the problems with filing a complaint is that it's very expensive to hire an attorney. And so No Fear 2 provides some assistance with attorneys so that the plaintiffs also have a fighting chance when they go into court.
Now, most of the Republican candidates have suggested that they would get rid of the EPA if they were elected president. I get the feeling from you that it wouldn't be all that different. Or do you think the EPA is still doing really important work?
No, I think the difference between me and the Republican position on this is that I want a stronger EPA, not a non-existent EPA. I want more regulations, not less regulations. But I think the problem is that when there's an absence of leadership, people will follow anyone. And I think we've had an absence of environmental leadership. And so I think the public is confused. And so we need to fill that gap with knowledge. And that's really what I try to do in my book.
Marsha Coleman Adebayo's victory in Coleman Adebayo versus Carol M. Browner inspired the passage of the No Fear Act of 2002. She's called her memoir No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA. It has a foreword by Noam Chomsky and an afterword by Walter E. Fauntroy, and it is published by Lawrence Hill Books. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much for having me.